There's been no shortage of prognostication this past week about what will happen if we don't reach a high level of vaccination, and desirable percentages for that seem to differ. And even if we quell this outbreak, how long before the next one? We're going a bit macro with that idea this morning with a new study out of the big private research university in the US, Duke, in North Carolina. It predicts, as many have, a new global pandemic comparable with the current COVID crisis, certainly in the lifetimes of young people under the age of 24 today, maybe a lot sooner. It even considers the possibility of an unstoppable virus. Anyone listening who was born in the year 2000 had a 38% chance, apparently, of experiencing a health crisis like COVID by 2021 if nothing were done to alleviate that outcome. And the question is whether, being presented with a percentage like that, we would have prepared more, and how could we? Dr. William Pan is with us, a professor of global environmental health at Duke. Hello, William.
Hi, good, nice to meet you.
Nice to talk with you. Your study looked back at the scale and frequency of disease outbreaks going back to 1600, including plague, smallpox, cholera, typhus, and new influenza viruses. How does that help you put a time frame on any next pandemic, William?
Well, in order for us to understand what might happen in the future, we really have to get an idea about what's been happening in the past. And then once we were able to properly create the data set, we could design and test a few models to see how we could fit the data. And then once we can fit the data properly with a model, and we are satisfied with the model fit and it looks pretty good and we compare it to other models, then we can get an idea about what might be happening into the future.
Okay, so you were looking for patterns. You found the rate at which outbreaks of whatever plague or pestilence appear, the rate is speeding up perhaps threefold, meaning that the probability of living through one is growing all the time?
That's correct. Unfortunately, that is correct.
We have a 2% chance. I hope I've got all the figures right, but we have a 2% chance of encountering something COVID-like every year, which sounds inconsequential, but the percentages add up and they may well be compounding. Is that what it's like?
It's sort of like that. If you can imagine flipping a coin, you know, if you flip it five times, in theory, it's 50% chance of heads. And what we're saying is that with a 2% chance, if you had a coin, or suppose you had some dice, each year you're flipping that coin or you're rolling that dice. And then the way the probabilities combine over time is what gives you that increased risk for at least one event of that size occurring. So that's basically what we're doing.
So statistically, it's a bit like also a 100-year storm happening again in 2 years' time, not in 100 years' time. And in the case of storms, we're all familiar with that sort of occurrence. So the next pandemic could, in theory, be 2023, William.
That's absolutely correct. And actually, you point out an interesting novelty to this analysis. My co-authors, they are coming from a climate science, hydrology, and atmospheric science area. And the way they describe probabilities of events are with these, you know, 100-year floods or 100-year hurricanes or typhoons or something like that. That's a different way of communicating compared to what I'm used to where I come from, the public health field. But that return time is an interesting and different way of communicating. But you're absolutely right. It basically means that each year you have that 2% probability. It could occur next year or it could occur 10 years from now.
So in your line of work, it's just like a new COVID-like virus popping out of a cave in China or a small town in Kansas next year. That's what you're considering.
That's what we're considering. That's what we're most concerned about.
So the last half century has been crucial for patterns, hasn't it? The trouble is we shove the evidence to the backs of our minds a bit.
Yeah, we've had, in the last 100 years, we've had some very unfortunate major events. And I think that's one of the big problems with us trying to move forward from this one is whether or not we will actually learn from some of the mistakes that we've made so that when the next pandemic hits, we don't repeat them all.
I know we're not telling our audience anything new in that sense, but can you remind us of the problems we have now that are fueling the likelihood of oncoming health disasters with less and less time between them, maybe?
The two most important ones are the basic public health interventions that we have for preventing transmission of disease. Number one, vaccines, right? So we didn't have a vaccine when COVID first emerged. But in other big pandemics, there has been a growing anti-vaccine movement. And now that we have a vaccine that can protect us against COVID, there is still this very large portion of society, and it exists everywhere, not just in the United States. It's particularly bad, but it exists everywhere that I've been, where there are people skeptical about the science, they're skeptical about the motivation, and it really breeds mistrust among people who might have otherwise taken a safe vaccine. So that's one big one. The other one are things like using a mask or social distancing. So when the Spanish flu hit in the early 1900s, it did not stop people from wanting to have massive parades. I mean, there were big parades in Philadelphia that resulted in a tremendous amount of cases occurring. We should make sure we wear masks and follow public health guidance. But that's not always the case, unfortunately.
You've identified the crucial dichotomy here, haven't you? Because you mentioned the vaccines, and human ingenuity is amazing when you see how quickly we got them. You're suggesting that human cleverness may not outrun new health challenges because of human intransigence at the same time.
That's a really hard question. I've always, before COVID emerged, I've always been a proponent of the idea that human ingenuity can solve a lot of the major problems that emerge among humans. I feel now I'm not as confident that human creativity and ingenuity can solve all of our problems, because that's only one part of the solution. The other part is gaining trust. They trust the intervention. They trust the recommendations that we make that allow us to use creative solutions. And I think that piece of human ingenuity and finding solutions for the future, not just for health, but for climate change, is something that we have not put enough effort into understanding.
Dr. William Pan is with us, a professor of global environmental health at Duke University. If I've got the maths right from your study, there could be a 76% chance, which is not a percentage we want to hear about, a 76% chance of a person in their 20s encountering a big eruption of infection from an animal reservoir in coming decades. And while we worry about that, it may also not be the only source of cataclysm, William.
I don't remember exactly the number, to be honest, but it is a range between like 60 and 70%, you're correct. Now, whether or not it's a zoonotic origin, we don't know. It could just be an emerging bacteria. It could be antimicrobial resistance that causes a massive number of cases and deaths. But the point of our paper was not to describe what kind of disease will emerge. If you look at all of the types of different pathogens that can cause major illness and death, the likelihood of one occurring, any one of those occurring in the next 60 years for a person's lifetime is quite high.
You do consider the big one, though, don't you? The pandemic capable of eliminating all human life. How would that happen?
Yeah. There were some prior papers that were published in Nature and Science that tried to estimate, the duration of mankind or humankind. There's different estimates out there, everything from 10,000 to 20,000 years. And based on our data, based on our model, we estimated that the timing of when the big one would hit us would be anywhere between about 12,000 to 13,000 years. We would have to have an incredibly contagious pathogen, likely a combination of an airborne pathogen and maybe a bloodborne pathogen, that is incredibly deadly, but not so deadly that it kills people quickly, but is something that is very contagious and is able to spread across all countries. So that's, it's hard to imagine what exactly that would look like. I mean, it's almost out, you know, something like a, you know, you'd have to read some books on outbreak and, you know, some of these movies like Pandemic or, and really imagine what that would look like. But I haven't quite wrapped my head around exactly what kind of pathogen that would be. It, in some ways, I don't want to wrap my head around that because that's a very scary proposition.
It is. But it's interesting because we may have thought as well that we are getting smarter than nature, that in the past, in which millions of years of evolutionary resistance would only let new DNA codes enter the biosphere incrementally. And as you say, science fiction's anticipated our overcoming that. You're actually talking about the opposite, aren't you? You're talking about nature triumphing despite how clever we get with our health and medical science.
Exactly. You know, if you go back to the Sustainable Development Goals, where we are trying to encourage the development of humans in concert and collaboration with nature, if we were to actually achieve the Sustainable Development Goals and create more sustainable development around the world, I think we would prevent any kind of major catastrophic pandemic that would wipe out humans. You know, we don't have to outsmart nature. We just have to partner with nature. We have to think of ourselves as part of the environment, and we have to think of ourselves as not just maintaining our own health, but maintaining the health of the environment that we live in.
To put it cynically, I mean, there are certainly votes for politicians in sustainability now, and maybe I shouldn't put that cynically because I think, you know, they believe in it as much as people who aren't politicians do. But there aren't many votes for politicians in spending money or using our money to set up structures to anticipate the worst in terms of health provision and so on. I mean, in our country, we're trying to earthquake-proof our buildings, and that's proving a difficult task. So what would we need to do, as well as partnering with nature, next time a virus jumps out of a pangolin or a bat?
Well, so that's a tough one. Politicians need to learn from what's happening right now to invest in infrastructure that strengthens the marginalized populations as well as the general population. Now, that's easier said, right? So the hardest challenge is how do you convince policymakers to invest in something like that? I actually think that we need new politicians. We need more people who are educated in science to be interested in politics. Not to say that researchers would be the best politicians, but I feel the most important job of a politician is to read the data, to interpret the data for their constituents, to make sure people have some fundamental skills to absorb information.
Speaking of understanding the data, we're losing the science, though, in many respects. That's the modern complaint. I was reading, without anything like full understanding, a genetic history of the plague and how an altered protein here and a mutated gene there can change everything. That's the science we don't apprehend. Yeah, it's the chance that things can go wrong at any time, which is basically part of what your study's about.
Yes, pathogens do change. They do change rapidly, but we can also detect them fairly rapidly. And I don't think the technology to detect change is beyond us. It exists now. It doesn't exist everywhere. It exists in many wealthy countries. It exists in some middle-income countries. It's just a question of whether or not we want to invest in that. In some ways, it's almost like insurance. You know, what's the probability of a new coronavirus-like illness mutating to become extremely pathogenic and deadly? Well, that's like our paper says, it's a fairly low probability, but there is a dollar sign or a monetary value behind investing in infrastructure that can allow us to detect whether or not, that particular new variant is emerging.
Your study's a real cautionary tale in that respect. Hey, thank you very much for your time talking to us about it too.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. I enjoyed talking with you.